Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
I had anxiety for a few years, and it was finally starting to die down. And basically, I was building up a force field around it. And then COVID hit like a meteor and created a big gaping hole. Oh, you remember that anxiety you got rid of? You get all of it now. Congratulations.
I really care about Black Lives Matter, and I really care about women rights. I also care about the environment a lot. I hate deforestation. I love reforestation, that means, as well. I care about that.
I've been organizing since I was 13. I don't think I am experiencing the life of like a regular 15-year-old, and I don't think I, to be honest, ever will be, unless there's like change before I graduate high school, but that's like part of my childhood that I have to sacrifice to this.
We just feel tired. We wake up every day knowing that we just have to make the money to make sure that we can pay our rent so that we can go to college. But for what point? A lot of us don't know. But it feels like we're just going through the motions of what we were expected to do, but we have no idea where we're supposed to go. And honestly, it just feels, I guess, depressing. So many of us feel depressed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And that was 19-year-old Ira Hager in Mount Vernon, Kentucky, 12-year-old Ellie Perry in Shoreview, Minnesota, 10-year-old Daphne Matsakis in Somerville, Massachusetts, and 15-year-old Anaya Butler in Oakland, California. You may hear a kind of world weariness in their voices, one that's familiar to you, weariness of the pandemic, of racism, of economic inequality, of climate uncertainty. But there's something deeper that I hear in their voices, or actually maybe it's really something that I'm not hearing in their voices. It's the absence of youthful optimism, of the effervescent hopefulness that, quite frankly, all of humanity relies on young people to have, to effuse, so that we as a species can move forward on their vision and on their energy. So I guess I'm hearing something that I don't really remember hearing as much in my own tween and teen years, and granted, that was 30 years ago. I hear a lot of pessimism. So, Alyssa Epple, do you hear that too? What do you hear in the voices of those young people we just played?
I hear the sum of everything they're experiencing from home, from school, from the media. And it is darkening their spirit, and it's heartbreaking.
Well, Alyssa Epple is a professor of psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco. She is a specialist in stress science with us from San Francisco. And Professor Epple actually first joined us last year in the early weeks of the international and national lockdown that we all experienced together. We were talking about mental health in the lockdown. And Professor Epple, I'm so glad you could join us again, because obviously there's a lot going on. And you know how I characterized it there as this something more than just pandemic anxiety that I feel like I'm hearing from young people these days? Just pessimism. Is that a fair way of categorizing it?
Meghna, that really is the word. And it's just so surprising. It's both a shock to hear such pessimistic, negative views of the world and their future. And it's so expected, it's so reasonable, given this confluence of the social and existential crises that really have pervaded their lives in the last few years. I mean, we already had a youth crisis in mental health before the pandemic and before the kind of crystallization this year of the climate crisis. We had increases in suicidality around 5% in our young adults and men and women. And now they're directly facing such an uncertain future. And the mental health the poor mental health has just skyrocketed. And it is in lots of, you know, we read paper after paper documenting suicidality, anxiety, depression, and it is certainly an epidemic upon an epidemic, but it's not one that we realize that we're really part of this. We are the social model, the adults, the parents. Kids are sensitive and perceptive. And so what are we feeling and what are we conveying? And are we taking care of our own mental health?
Mm. So help me understand what's happening here, because it sounds like, and actually, you've said this before. We played it in the little billboard at the top of the show, that there's this like crisis, in fact, even that we haven't really put some words or definitions around regarding kids and their mental health and their view of what's possible in their own lives.
Exactly. And I think what we see and hear sometimes things like a birth strike, like young women saying, this is not a world that I want to bring children into. And, you know, that's a shock to those of us who just assume, you know, grew up with these cheery childhoods and just assumed that we were going to have children and that things would be stable. But we live in an unstable climate, and we should expect worse climate news. Things will get worse before they get better. But we need to mentally prepare ourselves for that so that we're not shocked and victimized and demoralized, but that we understand here's the trajectories and here's what we can do. We have solutions in sight. So I think that there's a whole level of conversations that need to be happening fast and soon in this, you know, most constructive way that involves all levels of society. But I think parents have a very heavy toll, a heavy role in this.
Without a doubt. You know, so I'm just stuck on this word pessimism, because that's really what it feels like to me. I have some direct experience in hearing young pessimistic voices, to be perfectly honest. There's a difference between saying life is really hard, it's challenging, there are big problems that need to be solved, but maybe we can do it, right? And a difference between that and what I hear from not everybody, but also so many young people these days, that life is hard, it's challenging. There are existential problems that it doesn't look like we can solve at all. And then, as you just said, Professor Epple, therefore I'm going to make my life decisions based on the insolubility of these problems. I mean, that is just a completely different way of being than I expected we'd hear from so many young people.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Pessimism is a very strong personality trait, where you have this worldview where you expect negative outcomes, and it does shape our behavior. It leads us to, for example, take care of things less, to floss our teeth less, to not do prevention and take care of our health behaviors. And pessimists have worse health, and in some studies they die earlier. And so we know that it's a difficult way to live. But it is it is changeable. We also know that personality is changeable. I think what you're pointing to is really not personality. It's rather these attitudes that are being shaped and resulting from not just bad news that passes, but like you said, unsolvable global crisis, things that feel unsolvable, existential crises that are new to us. And we have been so relying on the strength of both time to heal things and the human spirit to recover. And people are resilient. People return to their good mental health within years after the most devastating personal crises. So this is the strength of the human spirit. And now we're dealing with, well, not only worrying about something in our personal lives or some event that might pass, but problems that are so vast in time and space, they seem unsolvable. So it's not irrational, but what is the problem is it is a distorted reality, because what we know what we see on the news is this curated negative picture. And every day there are amazing beautiful things that are happening and positive changes. And we don't hear about those. And we don't hear about the solutions nearly as often as we hear about the traumatic problems. Right. So part of this is an excessive pessimism that could be shaped and toward a more balanced and realistic view of what we need to do together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's so important, because it's the curated negativity, which we'll talk a lot about in a few minutes, but then sort of shaping worldview, which then can shape behavior. I mean, those are the interactions that I want to explore today, and sort of then how to break that cycle as well. Mm-hmm. And folks, just social media being one of the places of that curated negativity. But nevertheless, if you happen to be on Facebook or Twitter, we're at On Point Radio. Hop on there and let us know if you are seeing, or if you're a young person personally experiencing more pessimism and why, or if you're seeing something completely different. I always like examples that challenge the theses of our show. So go ahead and let me know if you're actually seeing reason for optimism, or young people who are behaving in ways that are in fact pushing back against pessimism. But again, we're at On Point Radio on Twitter and Facebook. And we've already got a comment from Christopher Maxwell here saying, adult nihilism is the most prominent reason for youth depression. They know they will pay the price of their parents' generation. We've just got about 30 seconds before the break, Professor Apple. Do you want to respond to that?
Yes. Kids are, they're sensitive and perceptive, and their attitudes are shaped by what we say, what we model, and what we feel, what we don't say, but we're projecting. And so the parents need to put their oxygen mask on. And during this little break, we're going to have breathe in the way we know calms us, slow, long, and smooth. Mm. That is step one for all of us.
Well, we are talking this hour about young people and pessimism about their present and future. And admittedly, this is a thesis that doesn't have a ton of data around it, but it has that feeling of, like, we call them shark fin stories here, that may rise to the surface any minute now. So we're trying to prepare ourselves for it. We'll have more in a moment. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're exploring this notion, because I can't really say that there's vast amounts of data around this, but this notion that young people these days are exhibiting much more pessimism, like really absolute pessimism about their future and futures than maybe we would want for them, that we'd want for any of us, and why that's happening, what impact it might have, and how to break that cycle. And today we're joined by Professor Alyssa Eppel. She's a stress scientist and psychiatry professor at the University of California, San Francisco. And she's joined us a couple of times over the past 18 months talking about mental health, especially during this pandemic. But of course, this is an issue that's much deeper than the pandemic, because can't blame a young person. Everywhere they look around the world, seems like there's a lot of bad stuff. So, for example, let's listen to the story of this young person on the West Coast.
My name is Zainab Javed. I'm 19, and I live in the Bay Area, California. I was in middle school. It was either 7th or 8th grade. And I was coming home from my local mosque with my mom. I was in the passenger seat and she was driving. And I remember looking ahead of us and saying, "Mom, I think that Mount Diablo is on fire." It's not a big mountain. It's just like a local mountain that everyone knows about. And as any good mother would do, she reassured me that no, it's just like clouds or whatever. But then later that night, my dad was watching TV and we saw that
Mount Diablo fire is burning in Contra Costa County, but people across the Bay Area are feeling the impact.
Lo and behold, Mount Diablo was on fire. And I think that's the first wildfire season that I really remember.
There are air quality concerns now in this area, stretching from the Tri-Valley down south to Santa Clara County.
In 11th grade was our first smoke day. You know, you always hear about kids in the East Coast having snow days where white snow is falling from above. They're excited, they're happy, they get to get off school, they get to play outside. And then smoke days are almost the exact opposite. Ash is falling from the sky and it's deemed a health hazard where you can't go outside and play or do anything. I was walking with my family in like downtown Culver City this summer, and it was just a big crowd of people, and I don't know what happened. I was just walking and something just hit me, and I was like, what if something happens right now? What if there's a mass shooting? Whenever I walk into a classroom, I kind of make sure I know where the exits are, I know where the windows are, because you never know what might happen. Is something that I don't think older generations get, especially one of my cousins, he's in his 30s, and on our cousin group chat, something came up about gun laws, and he said something, and I got really upset because I was like, you haven't been in school for God knows how long. You don't know what it's like. You don't know the anxiety behind sitting there and not knowing what a loud sound is. I often hear adults saying, like, oh, wow, the youth are so strong. They're so empowering. They're this, they're that. Okay, like, you think we're empowering. Thank you. You think we're strong. Thank you. But can you do something to improve our situation? Can you listen to us?
That's 19-year-old Zainab Javid from Danville, California. She volunteers with Youth Versus Apocalypse, a climate action group based in Oakland. Professor Epple, pick up right where she left off. How important is it for adults to listen to young people?
An amazing sharing from Zaina, and you know, you just want to fix things for her, and they're so, you know, complex. But starting with listening, sharing our own concerns, and really understanding that the anxiety or the worry is not going to go away or be solved easily, but that the most powerful way for us to manage these really scary threats is action. The most powerful relief from pain, sorrow, anxiety, anger is doing something about it. And so that she's got a group of youth that are working on climate together is one of the most powerful things she could do. These youth movements are also really hard for the youth, because no one has sustained attention. They can't sometimes get critical mass. So they also experience environmental burnout, just like adults do. But it's a, you know, it's an amazing movement that has had an impact. I feel so much for Zaina's experience. I also live in California. And when I have direct exposure to these fires and the smoke and the dark skies, it is really hard not to feel some despair. And so part of our new world and our new world mindset has to be talking about how to maintain this robust hope and this absolute hope, because we will feel despair. And, you know, Meghna, how did you feel when you read articles this week about, you know, there were so many that were hard to read, the Amazon and possible tipping points, and, you know, how do you respond and how do you manage that when you read one of these really pessimistic updates on the science of climate change?
Oh, okay. so that's a good question. I will admit that because of the work that I do, Professor Epple, when I'm engaging with those articles, I'm engaging with them from the point of view of, like, I need to understand how to digest this information in a way that then I can turn into something useful for listeners. So there's almost a, like, an intellectual distance, right, that I can put between myself and the content of what I'm reading, which is really helpful. And then the times that I cannot do that. Sorry, you just caught me off guard here, but I really actually appreciate it. It's good to be caught off guard. In the past couple of years, in the past 3 or 4 years, I just read less of it. I have started actively reducing the amount of negativity that I can choose to let into my life or not. So I read less of it, and I should just stop talking here for a second.
It's a beautiful answer. You brought forward two of the fundamental points. First of all, you're constructively doing something with the information, and the discussions and raising awareness and highlighting, you know, the constructive things that are happening is the answer. It is what we all need to do together. And so I used to, you know, I view myself as a convener now. I'm convening climate meetings and discussions about, you know, what we can do from our lane with our own skill set, how we can each find what we can do. And that feels amazing. And, you know, I don't have the big solutions, but my job is to figure out what my role is in the big social network of change. And that's all of our job. And so hearing about how you read it is beautiful. And dosing yourself is also just a, you know, a number one rule to good mental health in our new world. We are so surrounded by visual images and dramatic news and threatening words. And we have to limit our exposure to that news media. And that was the first thing that myself and many mental health colleagues were trying to educate the public about, that when we have a mass disaster, we are all vulnerable to PTSD, to anxiety, to actually having impact our health years later, if we are really very exposed to constant TV, visual images. That's a very bad, dangerous formula.
Yeah. You know, I'm about to say something that's just basically advocating for reduced consumption of the very industry that I'm in. But but look, we don't have a television in our house. And so, you know, that doesn't mean that we don't consume media, but it just comes much more controlled through Netflix, et cetera. But in terms of cable news television, there's zero of it in my house. And on the radio, basically, we listen to music or certain podcasts, and of course, WBUR, my local public radio station. But I mean, I'm just offering that as maybe the what we're trying to create at home is too extreme of an example. But the reason why, Professor Epple, is not because of actually me or my husband, but like I just don't want that stuff at home with my kids, because, I mean, this gets, maybe we're getting to part of the like, what can we do as adults? I just feel like there has to be some place, because media follows us absolutely everywhere. It's in our pockets 24/7. Mm-hmm. There has to be some place where there's a break from that. And we're trying to construct that in our home to various levels of success or lack of success. But, I mean, that, are we right to even attempt to do that?
Oh, those breaks are so critical and so important and so hard, because in all of this spaces in between activities, we have these phones, you know, we have the media available to us in an addictive way. And so it's gotten to the point where, you know, we need to, when we have dinner, we need to put our phones in a different room and just consciously just, you know, make the break with our screens so that we can have connection and conversation about things that are not the news. So I think it's wonderful that you don't have, you're a small minority to not have TV at home, and it's very healthy. Yeah. I think the What do we do as adults? I think we need to remember that hope is one of the most highly contagious emotions. And I'm so excited that you're bringing on Doug Abrams, because when I was in my, I think we should expect we're going to be experiencing the dialectic of despair and worry and concern, as well as joy and hope and awe in the beauty of the world and the beauty of nature. That is what is our true world now. We have both. And so learning to regulate and live with hope is a critical skill. So in my darkest moments, and I do have them and they will come again, I have some strategies for maintaining the optimism about our future and keeping me engaged in the work that I think will have a small but contagious effect. And Doug Abrams is actually one of the people that I call. I tried to flee the fires. I was feeling physically sick and nauseous, and I had a headache. And I took a train during COVID to Colorado to be with friends and have a break from the smoke. And what do you know? A few days later, the smoke came, and you know, I called Doug, and he said, "There's nowhere to go." And eventually, there really is nowhere to go. And so, it really is about from where you are, figuring out where you can have the biggest impact. And what I have come to is this idea of absolute hope, not hope that the fires won't be as bad next month, et cetera, not hope for specific outcomes, but a robust hope in the goodness of humanity that we can turn this around. And we are, not fast enough, but we are. Yeah. there are, and Doug will talk more about some of the changes happening.
Well, Professor Apple, since you have so beautifully allowed me that segue to Doug Abrams, let me just introduce him into the conversation. He's joining us from Santa Cruz, California, and he's co-author with Jane Goodall of The Book of Hope, A Survival Guide for Trying Times. And he's also founder and president of Idea Architects. Doug Abrams, welcome to On Point.
It's great to be with you both.
So we're going to talk a lot about absolute hope, as Professor Apple has described here. But the sort of the part of me that still pursues journalistic rigor wants to actually just check the entire premise of this conversation with both of you for a moment. Because you can look back at any point in human history, and we're getting comments already. David McGraw says, this is nothing new. I'm of the generation that was facing nuclear Armageddon. Yeah. So nuclear Armageddon, depression, cataclysmic world wars, genocide, other pandemics, you name it. Humanity has encountered not just, you know, singular challenges, but multi-layered challenges in the past. So are we seeing, in terms of young people and their pessimism, anything new now? Or is this just what is old is new again for yet another generation?
Well, Alyssa, if you want to take that,
I'll let you take that, Doug.
Okay. well, I guess what I would say is I think this is an important corrective, which is our generation did grew up under the threat of nuclear Armageddon. Working with Jane Goodall on The Book of Hope, she talked about World War II and the Nazis that were basically about to invade Britain and were held at bay at the beaches by, you know, Churchill's speeches alone. And I think it is unrealistic to think that we can kind of sugarcoat human experience or bubble wrap our kids to prevent them from being exposed to the great crises of our time or of any time. And so the question I think that Alyssa is raising, which is how do we create a kind of stress resilience and a kind of hopefulness? And you were talking about pessimism in this generation. I think I would make a distinction between pessimism and hopelessness or optimism and hope. Pessimism and optimism are dispositions or temperamental or kind of almost philosophies that people can adopt. I think what you're experiencing or what we're witnessing with this kind of unprecedented combination of sociological, biological, and ecological crisis is a kind of hopelessness and a sense of great fear, sadness, grief at the challenges that we're facing and what we're losing. And so the question is, how do we almost inoculate our kids from that despair or give them resources and tools that are realistic in order to confront those real challenges that we face.
Yeah. And Professor Epple, I just want to turn back to you. We've got 30 seconds before the next break. But I would say that the one distinguishing feature of the modern moment is what we were talking about earlier. And that is, I almost see that, like, a kind of neural shaping going on with the constancy of these, as you said earlier, curated negativity that young people are immersed in. That does feel different than perhaps in generations past.
We are being manipulated with social media. And so we are all experiencing a more negative view of the world. Emotions that have moral outrage, anger, and disgust, those go viral. And now we know that Facebook knows they go viral and they push them more. So we're actually being activated all the time and manipulated. And if we know that, we can actually counter that. So I'm just thrilled that that's out in the open now, because boy, our emotions are, you know, right, they're contagious, but our awareness and our meta-awareness and our mindfulness of them is our tool to regulation and protection.
We'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On Monday, we're going to be talking about the Federal Reserve, and specifically if the Fed is actually a primary engine of economic inequality in this country. So, you know, for a long time, there's been rock bottom interest rates. And we want to know, though, what impact has that had on your financial picture, your bank balance? If you're in the stock market, has that had an impact on your stock investments? What do you think about your financial security versus a decade ago, versus 15 years ago? We want to hear your economic story. We're at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That is for Monday. We're going to be talking about the Fed. Today, we are joined by Professor Alyssa Epple. She's a stress scientist and psychiatry professor at the University of California, San Francisco. And Doug Abrams joins us as well. He's co-author with Jane Goodall of The Book of Hope, A Survival Guide for Trying Times. And we're talking about young people and pessimism or hopelessness, as Doug thinks that we should be calling it here. And Alyssa and Doug, I'm going to come back to you in just a second, but I want to hear the voice of one more young person before we go on too long into this segment. This is someone who feels both very aware of the challenges around her and cautiously optimistic about the future.
My name is Hannah Baptiste. I'm 17 years old and I live in Brockton, Massachusetts. I felt very isolated. I had a lot of my activities cut from my schedule because they were either canceled due to COVID guidelines or they were restricted for upperclassmen. To get by, I would usually try and talk to my friends as much as I could. And during the last 18 months, any form of connection that you can find is good. During the pandemic, we could focus on ourselves a lot more, and we could focus on the world around us a lot more. We had the Black Lives Matter movement erupt, and then we had a lot of people getting evicted because they were losing their jobs due to COVID. And I just feel like even though the restrictions are loosening up, a lot of that is still present today, and it's important that no one forgets that. I do experience microaggressions a lot. Comments about my hair or about how well-spoken I am. People saying I sound white. It usually just comes as a shock. And in that moment, you just don't know what to say. I just think, am I really just well-spoken, or do you just not expect someone like me to sound that way? A lot of people are just standing up more for what's right. So I do feel like this generation can change the world. A world worth returning to is one where we can recognize the problems in our society and actually work towards fixing it. If we recognize it and make efforts to ending systems of oppression, making improvements in everyone's lives so everyone can live their best life, regardless of race, wealth, class, status. A world worth returning to is one where everyone is seen. In order to get that, we have to work towards it.
That was Hannah Baptiste from Brockton, Massachusetts. We connected with her when she submitted a poem about her experience during COVID to WBUR's Pandemic Generation Project, and we have a link to Hannah's poem at onpointradio.org. Now, Doug, we're first of all, talk about what Hannah says. How do we do what she's calling for? Like, in where do we begin in terms of working towards, if not achieving those solutions, but working towards a system where we can actually feel more hopeful?
Well, I think that hope is a social gift. It's something that we give to one another. Alyssa was saying that she calls me in her dark moments. I think we support one another in the process of finding those solutions. I think that's crucial. I think that it's really important that we demonstrate to our children and our young people. And I will say, I have had a child in crisis. I was a child in crisis when I was young. There's nothing more anguishing for a parent than to have a child who's suffering. And we obviously want to come in and take their pain away. But ultimately, I think it's crucial to both model that we are taking action ourselves. We are trying to solve the problems and activating hope in our world. And we're also being truthful with them and honest about the fact that there are challenges and there is a need for urgency, but there is also hope and there are solutions that we can pursue.
Yeah, you know, I have to be honest, we're getting some pushback on social media from folks, and I really appreciate it because it's both thoughtful pushback and what I'm seeing is that it's actually also modeling the kind of maybe hopelessness that we're trying to confront here. Because, for example, someone calling themselves Zax says, I agree that building resilience and in younger generations is important, but a big difference between climate change and the Cold War, World War II era, etc., is that we are not doing anything about it now. This person says, at least we fought the Nazis. And someone calling themselves Nim Chimpsky says, it's not about the goodness of humanity. That is just naive. It's about what behavior is incentivized and who is in power and what they want, which is to make money and keep their power. So, Doug, what do you hear in those comments?
Well, it's a great question. I actually asked Jane while we were working on the Book of Hope, you know, are we 51% good or 51% evil? And she said, she thinks we're split down the middle, and what we do is what our environment encourages. And this was just a kind of fascinating revelation to me because it made it clear that all the things that we lament in ourselves, our selfishness, our greed, our aggression, those are actually human qualities that evolved to help us in certain environments. And so the question is, what kind of a world do we create? What kind of a society do we create? What kind of a social media environment? What kind of schooling systems do we create? And what do we encourage in our young people? So I don't think, I do think that we are fundamentally a pro-social species. Mm-hmm. That is how we survived and evolved. And that we humanity does the right thing at the last possible moment. I do think that we will rise to the challenges of our time, and that we have to encourage, we have to show our kids that we are rising to the challenges of our time. But I think, for those of us who grew up during the specter of nuclear Armageddon, we didn't feel like the adults were doing the right thing. And I think that climate change is a particularly challenging thing because it is not something that we control, the switch on a nuclear bomb. And the enemy is not as clear as it was in World War II. But I think that the battle is within ourselves. It's within our own nature to see whether we support those better angels of our nature or not.
So can you just tell me more brief about hope being perhaps an evolutionary adaptation? I mean, is that what you're talking about? And you and Jane Goodall? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So what Jane said was that hope is a fundamental human survival trait. And when we looked at the science of hope, it evolves in the prefrontal cortex, in the part of our brain where language and problem solving and our kind of pro-social morality also are located. It is something that evolved to help us to survive. And it is, it's really fascinating. There are, four fundamental components that hope requires. Hope requires realistic goals, realistic pathways, a sense of agency or confidence that you can realize those goals, and social support. And any kind of lasting, I will say, as a born and bred New Yorker, I was kind of skeptical about hope going into this project with Jane, because New Yorkers don't really do hope. We do fear, we do anger, we do outrage, cynicism much more comfortably. And hope can feel like a kind of a weak response in some ways. Let's hope for the best. But ultimately, what I discovered from Jane is that real hope requires this kind of true engagement and action. It's not a kind of passive response and a passing the buck to somebody else. It's actually something we engage in.
I think you're being unfair to New Yorkers, Doug, because the other part of New York that I see is the gateway into the hopefulness of a new future with the welcoming of millions of new Americans.
For sure.
Talk about the fundamental act of hope, leaving everything behind and coming to try something new. But Professor Epple, thank you for listening so patiently along with us. How do we turn what Doug's talking about into practice? Because I'm seeing comments here. This is Maureen O'Keefe, who sent us this message on Facebook. I'm not sure how to model optimism for my kids when I'm not optimistic myself. It's really difficult as someone who values truth-telling as a parent also.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really important to be honest to a certain extent. When I read some of these climate news, I want it to say R-rated, or, it's not fit for our youth to directly read these. So there is some level of kind of translation that we need to do. But I think, sharing, I am concerned too. And I am worried, not acting like we're just hoping for the best and humanity always has self-correction. And, those are self-comforting statements that are a bit empty. I think Hannah Baptiste said it just so well. I think we need to keep doing the ongoing work. The little bit that we can do in our power together adds up. And we've witnessed remarkable social changes in our lifetime. Then just recently, the Black Lives Matter movement, the Me Too movement, before that, gay marriage. These are big social changes that people have been chipping away at for years and years. And then there's a tipping point. The tipping point only has to be, 5% or, maybe 10% of people. We're never going to convince everyone to be working together and in step. But if we have a small active group. So I want to say that, I agree with Doug that hope and the science is, fascinating about hope having this evolutionary purpose. And the same with joy. And so, and I don't mean pleasure, short-term pleasure. I mean, what brings us true, you know, meaning and purpose in life. And that is social connection, positive social connections, kindness to others, and doing things that we feel are meaningful to really just do our part. And that doesn't, while that may sound Pollyannish, there's amazing science behind these ways of promoting emotional well-being that are actually acts of social repair for ourselves or for others. And we have actually built an app based on the book that Doug wrote with His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Bishop Desmond Tutu, The Book of Joy. We want to spread joy. The documentary on this book is called Mission Joy, and our app is called The Big Joy Project. We just want people to try out these short-term ways of experiencing joy. And when you look at what the acts are, there, you know, one is even sign, you know, do something for a social cause you care about. That makes us feel happy. It makes us feel relief. It is the magic of what's accessible to all of us now.
Mm. And we're going to have links to that at our website, onpointradio.org. And this is where I think in an age that we're living with these planetary challenges, it's a little counterintuitive to realize that the most effective thing we can do is actually extremely local, right? It's local to our lives, to our friends, to our families, to our in real life networks here. So Doug, can you talk about that a little bit? That perhaps the greatest antidote to planetary existential threats could be what you can do within the reach of your own hand, in other words.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that we need industrial level and government policy change without a doubt.
Sure. Yes.
But that ultimately, this is not going to be solved by paper or plastic. That's not, you know, how we're going to deal with our climate crisis. But ultimately, our own purchasing decisions, our own voting decisions impact the world. I mean, you look at a young woman like Greta, you know, whose protests unleashed a global youth movement. And, you know, I think each of our actions have this incredible potential to either give hope to others and activate hope in others. And I should also mention that with Jane Goodall, we're doing a global free hope summit that people can participate from anywhere in the world that has a lot of resources for how people can act locally and get engaged. And actually, I think, you know, that ability to modulate and regulate your own exposure to the negativity, as you were talking about before, is important. But I think ultimately it's really, as Alyssa was saying, about getting active. Mm. That is the thing that gives us the most enduring hope.
Well, Alyssa, we just have a minute left here. And I do actually feel quite hopeful about this simple conclusion that at least I'm coming to this hour, that we push back against pessimism by at least trying to experience fundamental joy or making some kind of change that we can see, we can measure in our own little spheres. Is that right?
Absolutely. I think we can't control the uncertain future. And so what we control is what is here now and in our day. And making those spaces that you talked about that are so rare to disconnect from the media and the news, and being connecting with people who are in front of us and allowing time for self-care. Mental health must come first. We have to reduce stigma. We have to, as adults, as parents, as teachers, share our own universal humanity. We are in a new era where authenticity is an essential piece of how we connect and survive together, showing our vulnerability. We, you know, humans, we're imperfect. We suffer, but we need to, you know, seeking help is a sign of strength. So I think for having discussions about mental health and reaching out to people and admitting if we're not even admitting, that's a terrible word, but talking about if you go to therapy or take meds, these shouldn't be secrets. We are all struggling.
Well, and now at least We also know the beginnings of the way forward. So, Professor Alyssa Epple and Doug Abrams, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.